Hello, welcome to Outside In. I'm John Burns, and I've got climber mountaineer Charles Sherwood in the studio today to talk about his brand new fantastic book, Seven Climbs. Hi, Charles. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for having me.
Great. Oh, you're very welcome. And your book comes out very shortly. I think, in fact, this is the first. I'm very honoured. This is the first book launch I've actually had on my little podcast. And your book's called Seven Climbs. How did the idea for the book come about?
Well, actually, you say the book just came out. I literally got the first copy yesterday. It felt like giving birth, although I'm not sure my wife would appreciate the comparison.
It's a lot of hard work, a book. It certainly is, yeah.
The book's full name is Seven Climbs, Finding the Finest Climb on Each Continent.
Right.
And I guess that subscript gives a clue as to what it's all about. The idea came to me a few years ago, the end of one climb that had been rather special, that maybe I could find similar, unique, iconic climbs around the world that would form a group of the world's best climbs.
And were you looking for trying to find an iconic climber, a very special mountaineering route? What qualities do you look for? What makes an outstanding climb, do you think?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of factors there. I mean, there are the sort of obvious ones, the aesthetic beauty of the mountain, technical challenge that perhaps it offers, its unique remoteness, wilderness characteristics, perhaps the personal relationship that you have with that mountain for history. But I think what really makes a climb special, and I would draw a bit of a distinction here between a mountain and a climb,
right,
it is to do with people.
Uh-huh.
So a mountain at the end of the day is a pile of rock, snow and ice.
Yeah.
What makes it special for me is the history of the people that have interacted with that mountain, that have created a route to its top by one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
And my own personal experience. So it's kind of the three things. It's the mountain, it's its past history and interaction with people, and it's the personal experience you have when you engage on that mountain.
Yeah, I can understand that. I mean, in a way, I suppose, certainly in Scotland, probably Ben Nevis is the iconic mountain, because it's got such a long history of pioneering snow and ice routes on it. And it's a special place for that. So which seven routes did you pick? Just very briefly to ask you that.
Yeah, well, let me list them for you, and perhaps just give a very quick flavour of why I think each one was particularly interesting. So in South America, I felt the southwest face of Alpa Mayo was uniquely beautiful. It was actually voted by Alpinismus magazine and readers in 1966 as the most beautiful mountain in the world, even though the main route that we took was not climbed for another 9 years after that.
Right.
In Asia, there is something very special about the southwest ridge of Amadablam. I think it is generally recognized that it would to be the first technical ascent really made on a big Himalayan peak, back in 1961. Mount Kenya, traverse of Mount Kenya. I think if one's looking for something that somehow represents Africa, Kenya is sort of a quintessential place to go.
Yeah.
We did it immediately following a climatization warm-up in the form of a trek up Kilimanjaro.
Right.
And somehow to do the three highest, climb the two highest peaks on Mount Kenya. So in the course of the traverse, so in effect, completed the three highest mountains in Africa in a week, and there was something rather unique about that.
Okay.
In Australasia, I felt very strongly that whatever climb we did had to be in New Zealand. It's sort
right.
of the home of Southern Hemisphere climbing.
Yeah.
I actually went out to New Zealand not knowing whether the route that I would choose would be the southwest ridge of Mount Aspiring, which is the most beautiful ice climb in the country, or the Linda Glacier route on Mount Cook. It's probably the best known mixed route in the country.
Mm-hmm.
In the end, I actually climbed both. And Mount Cook, somehow, we had a 20-hour day on Mount Cook, and it was a day to remember. So I think that finally took the top place.
Okay.
And then in Antarctica, it was all about finding a journey. It was all about the remoteness. I've done climbs in Europe where I've been 800 meters from a helicopter rescue. In South Georgia, we were 800 miles from a helicopter rescue.
Okay.
Plan A was self-reliance, and Plan B was to make Plan A work. That's, you know, that's kind of a unique environment.
Yeah.
So all those were sort of five. And then the remaining two, I think, speak very much to that combination I was talking about earlier of the mountain, the history, historical context of the climbing on the mountain.
Yes.
And my personal experience. And those were the nose on El Capitan. And the north face of the Eiger.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the north face of the Eiger. I mean, I was thinking it probably is the most famous climb in the world. It's if you spoke to a lot of non-climbers, it's probably the climb that they could mention. And I think that also the even some pictures on it, Traverse of the Gods and things like that. That's if that's still there, then it is. But that's got iconic status because the climbing of the Eiger was actually it was actually a very political thing, wasn't it?
Well, as you know, it was certainly back in the 1930s. It was the great Teutonic Dream.
Yes.
And a series of German and Austrian teams attempted to climb the face in 35 and 36 with disastrous results.
Yeah.
But then that famous German-Austrian team of four that finally got up the route in 1938, and that was the route we followed. I was very keen to do the 1938 route.
Right.
The extraordinary thing is about the north face of the Eiger. I mean, put it in context, we were not a strong team, so you can assume that the conditions were reasonably good when we did our climb on in 2007.
Yeah.
And yet, despite those reasonable conditions, and despite the North Face of the Eiger being, as you say, possibly the most famous climb in the world, in the 4 days, despite all that, in the 4 days that we were on that mountain, we never saw another human being.
Really?
Any hint of another human being.
That's surprising, isn't it, really? And the North Face of the Eiger is famous for its objective dangers, its stone fall and things like that. How did you find it when you climbed it then?
Well, we had our moments. I suppose for me, a particular moment was when we were on the second ice field. And it was about 8 o'clock at night. The sun had completely gone. I was climbing by my headlamp. Fortunately, I was not leading. My partner was well up ahead of me. And as I was sort of teetering on my front points and crampons, and axe points, all hell broke loose above me. And I had a huge rock and ice fall that came down, gashed open my nose, and completely took out my headlamp. So that, so my memory of climbing the second ice field is particularly sharp in my mind, because I climbed it entirely in the dark. And I mean, when that happens, sort of two things occur to you. One is, what the hell am I doing here? And the second is, what the hell do I do next? And I discovered, when faced with what seemed like a big challenge at the time, the answer is you do one little step by one little step. And I remember climbing the whole of the second ice field, and it was right back to basics. It was 3 points of contact at all times, steady upward progress. I couldn't see what I, where the axe was going in, but I could feel it. Fortunately, it was quite uniform ice. And eventually I was reunited with my partner above. although not desperately impressed with the filet he brought me up on.
So it sounds like the North Face sort of lived up to its reputation, really, didn't it? And I certainly know what you mean about when you're in a crisis. It, I've never climbed anything remotely as hard as North Face of the Eiger, but I was avalanched once in Canada. And when you're in a sort of crisis like that, I always feel it feels almost too big, too enormous to take on in a one-up. And my feeling was, well, if I survive the next 10 seconds, and then I'll try and survive the 10 seconds after that. Is that the sort of attitude that you had there?
I think it is, and I think it's a very good description, John, and I think it captures not only the experience I had on that ice field, but actually also something I took away with me into future life. It's really, I don't know whether you've read Heinrich Harrer's famous book, The White Spider. He talks about, actually not in respect to the second ice fall, but he talks about being on the white spider and the experience he had there, and made the point, he had a particularly challenging experience on that section of the climb, and he made the point that for the rest of his life, when he encountered a real difficulty, as he puts it, when a spider's web lay across my path, he would go back in his mind to the white spider and the lessons he learned there, and the way he coped with that, and that helped get him through. And I had, it seems a bit immodest to be comparing myself with Heinrich Harrer, but I had a similar kind of learning experience from the second ice field, because about 2 years later, the business that I had helped found got into serious difficulty. And I had to negotiate a restructuring of a major part of it. And I remember sitting in those meetings thinking, just stay calm, stay rational, stay objective, move steadily forward, and remember, however badly this goes wrong, it's only business. Nobody is going to die. And you do get that kind of perspective. I'm delighted to say the business, we did agree a deal, the business recovered and has never been stronger than it is today. But but it was a lesson for me, I felt.
So that climb
on that mountain.
The North Face certainly sounds like it left an impression on you. And one of the other mountains, or climbs that you spoke about, was El Cap. Can you tell us a little bit about that route, maybe?
Well, I mean, it's another classic route, isn't it? Full of history.
Yeah.
I mean, that period 1957 to 58, so in particular, sort of the ultimate drama in the Yosemite Valley, with characters straight out of central casting. I mean, Royal Robbins and Warren Harding.
Sure.
So, you know, Royal Robbins, the incredibly organized, careful, sober planner, who put up what at the time was the most spectacular route in the valley, the northwest face of the Half Moon. And then clearly what he wanted above all was to climb El Capitan. And along came this completely contrasting character, Warren Harding, a carefree, womanizing playboy, who stole, I'm sure in the eyes of Royal Robbins, stole from him the most magnificent route of all in the valley, the first route up El Capitan in 1958, the nose.
And is the nose the route that you took then?
It is, yeah. I think, I mean, El Cap is a magnificent cliff, and in fact, I've climbed it a couple of times. I mean, Alex Honnold's described it as the most impressive wall on Earth. But actually, I wanted it to be even more specific than that. I wanted to do the classic route.
Right.
In the footsteps of Warren Harding, all those months he took to put up that very, very first ascent. For me, that truly is unique.
How long is that route? Tell a little bit about it. It's up the nose, isn't it?
Well, I mean, people do it in hours, much as Uli Steck did on the Eiger in his day. It took us 6 days.
Oh, wow.
But it was we were a party of three. We had one very experienced member, which was Andy Kirkpatrick.
Oh, right, okay.
I had done only one big wall route before, south face of Washington Column in the valley. And, I mean, Max had done things like the north face of the Matterhorn, but he'd never done any aid climbing in his life before that. So right. We were not the speediest.
Yeah. And this involved what always looks the scariest thing to me, sleeping on those little tiny platforms. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, they're the portalege.
Portalege, that's the word.
They're actually very comfortable.
Oh, really?
Well, they're very ergonomic. And they're also safe in the sense that, I mean, obviously everybody's worry is, oh my God, you know, I could roll off the thing.
Yeah.
But actually, you never take your harness off.
Yeah, you're tied on. You're
permanently, you know, anchored into the main safety system. Having said that, if you did roll off, it'd be one hell of a way of waking up.
It would sort of get your attention, really, wouldn't it? I would imagine.
The abyss.
Yeah. You wouldn't want to forget where you are and decided to go for a pee, would you? Really? wouldn't be a good idea.
One of the great subjects discussed endlessly at length on big walls is that very subject.
Oh, right.
Going for a pee and even more major activities.
Yes, I can imagine that would be very, very, very challenging, really.
There's not a lot of privacy on a portal.
I think there is. I see. And, well, of all the routes you've done, if you this is the most difficult question, probably almost impossible to answer, but of all the routes you've done, of those seven routes, if you had to pick one as the outstanding route, which one do you think it would be? It's gone quiet.
I think I can get to two routes.
Right. Okay. We'll give you two.
And I think they would be, in fairness, they would be the ones we have talked most about on this chat. I mean, they would be the Eigervand and the nose on El Capitan. I think what makes those routes so special goes back to, you know, that combination I was talking about, people and mountain.
Yeah.
If I had to choose one, well, you know, Europe is my backyard, so I guess it would have to be the Eigervand.
Right. I mean, I the Eiger, I've been there, and it has, how can I put it? It has a kind of atmosphere that I've not experienced anywhere else. Did you feel that?
Oh, I think it's an ugly brute.
It is, yeah, it's not particularly scenic, is it?
No, it's
dark and threatening, and I found it quite a menacing place, but I don't know whether that was just my psychology at the time, you know?
Yeah, no, it doesn't smile, it kind of grimaces.
That's exactly right, exactly. But that, in a way, but that adds to the challenge, doesn't it? I mean, and I suppose one of the things about that route is that it is a bit of a lottery in a way, because you could have been killed by that rock fall quite easily by the sound of it.
Yeah, you are. You have to accept, I think, you are taking some degree of chance. It is a quite hostile environment. Although I'll say one thing. There is a treat at the end of each day.
Oh, right, okay.
Basically, the Eiger sort of kind of broods in its own, or the north face of the Eiger broods in its own shadow for entire day. But for just 1 hour before sunset, at least if you're climbing when we were in September. Well, 1 hour before sunset, the sun peeps around and casts this sort of warm glow that you've been desperate for each day. And it's kind of the reward before night. That's rather nice.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. So you must be very pleased that your books are about to appear.
I am. I enjoy enjoy the process of writing. I'm sort of one of these nerdish types that keeps a daily journal,
right?
And actually, you know, gets pleasure from it. I find writing about these climbs is both a creative process, but also a way of kind of reliving the climb for better or for worse, sometimes for worse. It's always
why did I do that? Yeah.
So it has been rewarding writing the book, and it's great to have it out, and I hope others will enjoy it.
I'm sure they will. And do you think this is your last book, or do you think you might put pen to paper again?
Well. I think I'll get past this one first.
Yeah. One pick at a time, maybe.
I'm not sure what my wife would think of that.
Yeah, we'll just survive this section first, eh? Okay. Well, listen, it's been fantastic talking to you. Thanks very much for coming on the show, and I wish you every success with the book.
Thanks okay. Very much. It's been fun.
Okay, that's great. Thanks. Bye-bye.
I really enjoyed talking to Charles there. Fascinating little discussion, I thought. But then I would, wouldn't I? I was taking part in it, I suppose. But I would just like to say that, you know, I'm open to suggestions for guests. And Neil Davidson, through Facebook's Mountain Bothies Association page, suggested I talk to Heather Morning, who is Mountaineering Scotland's safety officer, I think. I do have a history of getting these things wrong, but I think that's who she is. All I can say is wheels are in motion. I'm hoping to have Heather on the show fairly soon. Charles's book will be available from Thursday, which is only useful if you can remember what day it is today. I think they should, under lockdown, I think what you do is they should bring back the town crier, okay? And all you would do is walk round the street shouting, "It's Monday! It's Monday!" I'd find that bloody useful. Anyway, just so that you know, Charles's book, Seven Climbs, will be available from Vertebrate Publishers from Thursday, the 7th of May. I do hope you've enjoyed this little podcast, and I hope to see you again. You take care. Bye-bye.